Hey guys, welcome back to Positive Impact with Andrew Schultz, episode number 42. And with me today is a very special friend, mentor, somebody who is very important in my family's life. And his name is Dr. Harry Hartounian, affectionately known as Dr. Harry. Dr. Harry, I'm going to read his bio. It's kind of lengthy because he's kind of a big deal, so bear with me. Has helped individuals and families suffering from the disease of addiction for nearly 40 years via his role as doctor, author, lecturer, sponsor, and friend. Dr. Harry is an internationally known speaker and authority on topics of addiction and recovery from the disease of addiction and has been featured in the New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Huffington Post, and appeared on the Dr. Oz Show, Dr. Drew on Call, and the Dr. Phil Show. Following a 30-year history of family and sports medicine in southern Vermont, Dr. Harry spent the next 13 years as a physician director of professional and residential programs at the world-famous Betty Ford Center in Rancho Mirage, California, where I am with Dr. Harry as we speak in his office. Board certified in both addiction and family medicine, Dr. Harry worked with thousands of patients in treatment ranging from high-profile celebrities and CEOs to stay-at-home moms and older adults. Over the years, Dr. Harry served as a consultant to major treatment centers, professional sports teams, and Fortune 500 companies. As a recovering physician himself, he has great passion for helping other doctors and professionals, including entertainers, business leaders, members of Congress, athletes, and their families. Finally, Dr. Harry, president and founding director of Dr. Harry Hartounian, MD, a professional corporation delivering addiction treatment services designed to help populations not well served by traditional treatment models with offices here in Rancho Mirage and Beverly Hills. His approach is discreet, focused, intense, and confidential. His work is with limited patients at any given time, so his attention is focused on the preparation and follow-up required for successful outcomes. He is also the author of Not As Prescribed, Recognizing and Facing Alcohol and Drug Misuse in Older Adults, as well as a second book, Being Sober, which I have here with me, Getting Through and Staying in Recovery. He also created Recovery 101, a series of taped lectures on the topics of addiction, medicine, recovery issues, and communication skills. With that being said, Dr. Harry, welcome and thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you, Andrew.
So, first off, I just want to acknowledge you for the work that you have done, the work that you continue to do, the work that you will continue to do, not only on behalf of me and my family, but the thousands and thousands of other people you have helped save their life, been of service to, and changed the trajectory of their families just like you have as mine. And so I just have an immense amount of gratitude, a heart full of appreciation for what you've done for me and so many other families. So thank you.
Pleasure is all mine, I can assure you.
So a little backstory, those of you that know my story, Dr. Harry was the doctor that helped my father in 2009 when he came to Betty Ford Center. Dr. Harry was his doctor that helped my dad get sober. It was the Christmas miracle on Christmas morning that we did the intervention and saved my dad's life. And Dr. Harry worked his magic and over the course of, you know, 3 or 4 months helped save my dad's life, get him back on a road to recovery. And then my family repaid the favor when they did the intervention on me, and I came to Betty Ford Center 4.5 years ago on April 30th, 2015. And it's so important that I have Dr. Harry on because, you know, the intention of this podcast is to share my appreciation with you and everybody else, inspire hope that there is hope out there for people who are struggling with addiction, and to amplify the message of what Dr. Harry is doing. At the end of the podcast, I'm going to give everybody his contact information because he has a concierge service that is very valuable for anybody seeking help, that I will share all of his contact information at the end of the podcast so you can get a hold of him and know where to reach him. But such a big part of my family's life. And I just want to say thank you again. Can you start out kind of talking about your journey with addiction and just kind of let everybody know that, you know, you are one of us and there's a lot of street cred in that, and just kind of share, you haven't always wanted to be, I think, where you're at right now. Like as a kid, we don't want to be an addict or alcoholic, but tell us about your journey and how it kind of came to fruition, if you don't mind.
Well, thank you again, Andrew, for that lovely introduction. I think, like many children of an alcoholic parent, my dad was an alcoholic. We vow during those troubled years of pre-adolescence and adolescence never to really become like that person. And I did that. And then went on my merry way. My dad passed away when I was just 21 and in medical school. And I finished medical school and established a practice and went on my life and realized that I was a workaholic, pretty much a workaholic, and which is a very important dynamic for any would-be addict, because the more you work, the more you feel entitled to party when it's time off. And of course, as a physician, I would have to manipulate my sleep-wake cycle as much as I possibly could, mainly because I was the only physician in town, in a small country town during the weekdays, in a large country town on weekends when people came in from New York City to go skiing. It wasn't too long after that that my system that managed my potential for alcoholic drinking started to fail. And at one point around 2000, I had, actually 1999, I had a pretty bad year. During that year, a practice that I had set up at Big Bear went bankrupt and cost $1 million. During that year, my mother, who lived with us for about 25 years, died of a prolonged ovarian cancer. During that year, I was busted for a DUI in my own town by a trooper that I delivered. And during that year, I lost my colon in an emergency surgical procedure. It was right after that that I just said, well, this is probably plenty enough signals that my life is rather unmanageable and I needed to do something about the way that I was drinking, which was mainly to get myself to sleep at night and rest for the next day of workaholism. And I was indeed becoming just like my father. So that's what happened. And I went to the Betty Ford Center for treatment, and the rest is rather self-evident from your introduction, I guess. Addiction medicine bit me hard. I liked it very much and decided to study it and become specialized in that for the second half of my career.
Okay. So let's just jump right in, because there's so much good content that I want to talk about that I know people are going to love. Based on your expertise. And again, Dr. Harry is one of the leading experts in the field of addiction. So again, I'm really excited to chat with you. So starting out, is addiction a disease?
Absolutely. It behaves like any other disease. It is not under conscious control. It occurs in an area of the brain that is not in the conscious area or the control area. So although people will say and think oftentimes that it is a matter of self-will, run riots, that addiction is, once it takes off, uncontrollable. There's self-will and choice on the first exposure to a drug, but oftentimes after that, the disease has a life of its own, and it's a special kind of disease. It's chronic, lifetime, organic disease of the brain that doesn't go away, goes into remission, is not curable, and is fatal. the reason the disease concept is so important is that many people fail to get treatment because part of this disease is denial and a great part of it is shame.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't believe in the disease concept, then you're going to think it's a character defect and you should be ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody is afraid to get treatment for their diabetes because they're ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we like to make sure that everybody knows it's a disease, and I make that point in my books.
Yes, and I'm glad you, A Matter of Choice, page 3 in his book, Being Sober, which it's such a great resource, guys. And I will put this in my show notes so you guys can find out both of Dr. Harry's books. It says, we can define disease as a loss of function of an organ or organ system that produces a set of symptoms with a known or unknown cause. For example, diabetes has a target organ, the pancreas. We know the cause, which is a dysfunction in insulin production or an insulin's action at the cellular level. And so, great example of Matter of Choice versus disease, right?
Correct.
So can you talk about physiologically, when somebody puts a drink or drug in their system, walk us through what happens?
Well, most of the drugs that people use recreationally work in our pleasure and reward system, which uses a neurotransmitter called dopamine.
Mm.
So they will either increase the amount of dopamine release, which gives a pleasurable feeling, or decrease the amount of which released dopamine is reabsorbed into the body. So the end result is a higher level of dopamine. That feels good. Unfortunately, with the phenomenon of tolerance for any drug, the amount of dopamine that feels good requires more and more of the substance to produce the same effect. And so people start drinking more, using more to get to the same place until eventually it doesn't work. And the weird part about this cunning and baffling disease called addiction is people will still be obsessed with using even when there is no more pleasurable symptom.
Mm.
So that's...
And on page 5 of the book, it talks about the dopamine, and drugs of abuse affect the midbrain by causing it to release 2 to 10 times more dopamine than natural rewards do. So if we're smoking or injecting our drug, the effects can be immediate and long-lasting. At first, the high is bigger, better, stronger than the natural high most of us get from pleasurable activities. Our brain rewards us for using drugs, and drawn to the dopamine, we do it again over and over. So what is the difference of somebody who has addiction and somebody who doesn't have addiction physiologically in the brain? What's the difference?
Well, there are many people who are still dependent on drugs that are not addicted to drugs. And that happens a lot in the older population in pain treatment, where patients are given Vicodin, for example, but never exceed the given dosage. Mm-hmm. But they can go on that way for years and years and years. And they become dependent on that drug because if they stop it, they're going to have withdrawal symptoms. In addiction, the essence is loss of control. There's no control involved. Craving for the drug of choice is very high, and persistent use despite adverse consequences. Mm-hmm. So in addiction, the compulsion is to use despite adverse consequences, and oftentimes you're not getting the pleasurable effect any longer, just the negative effects.
Mm. And so somebody listening at home right now, if they hear what you have to say, whether, you know, there's alcoholism, there's alcohol, there's drugs, there's so many isms when it comes to addiction, correct?
There is.
So if somebody's listening at home right now, how do they know what symptoms to look for, or maybe in a loved one? Can you give some more examples of how symptoms might be playing out where people can look for and help loved ones get the help they need?
Sure. Persistent use despite adverse consequences is usually one of the key elements of what now is called substance use disorder.
Okay.
And substance use disorders can be mild, moderate, or severe, and they are drug or alcohol specific. So substance use disorder, alcohol severe, is a specific diagnosed entity. So people would have to look at their behavior with the drug. Are they continuing to use despite adverse consequences? Are they continuing to use and put themselves in dangerous situations, like driving a car while drinking? Are they spending far more time than they would like seeking out and obtaining their drug of choice? Are they using more than they intend? There's a set of 11 questions that we ask that will give us the diagnosis, and you get the idea of what they're about. Are you continuing to use despite negative consequences in your relationship? That's a big one that many people can identify with. Well, yeah, drinking just, you know, is my prerogative and it doesn't bother anybody else except me, which is not simply not true. Ask any kid or wife of an alcoholic and they're going to tell you they're very much affected. So these 11 questions, if we get three or four correct as yes answers, we'll diagnose mild substance use disorder. 6, 7, 8 will be moderate substance use disorder. And many people come in answering 10 or 11 of these questions as yes answers, and those people have substance use disorder severe.
All right, so patient comes in. What behavioral therapies do you recommend? Because there's obviously not a one size fits all. There's the 12 steps and there's so many different therapeutic programs out there. How do you know which one works for each person?
Well, it's understanding that the disease has really four components: biological, psychological, social, and spiritual. So someone who has a large drinking or drug problem may have biological consequences. Obviously, the therapeutic approach for that's going to be medical. They have liver problems, they need a liver specialist. Blood problems, they need a blood specialist, etc. Psychological, well, then there are specific therapies that work. Group therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. For adolescents, other therapies. For people with other co-occurring mental health problems, dialectic behavioral therapy, if there's a borderline personality in there, and there may be depression or anxiety. There may be medical therapeutics that are needed for people in those situations. There's medically assisted treatment. Then there's the relationships, the social aspect and the spiritual aspect, group therapy, marriage and family therapy, couples counseling, and spiritual or pastoral therapies are all very important. So, you know, the list is long. But the mainstay, if you want to read some of the literature for alcoholism, for example, is Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, a fellowship, a spiritually based fellowship, together with cognitive behavioral therapy, started out with medically supervised detoxification, may be all it takes. And but engagement in a fellowship program has consistently been up there with cognitive behavioral therapy as being the most efficacious.
So the community aspect, the community, because
therapeutic community, yes.
Yeah, I know for me, addiction equals isolation. And I was in my apartment, and I know for a lot of people, share that addiction equals isolation, but for me, recovery equals community. So can you speak a little bit more about why that's so important?
Well, if you want to talk about the term spirituality, the other word is connection, of course. Mm-hmm. And I think that nurturing the soul in a disease that has spiritual implications cuts through the incomprehensible demoralization that people feel, the hopelessness, the faithlessness that they endure, the self-deprecating behaviors and the worthlessness that mm-hmm. they feel. We have to nurture the soul with this disease, and that's best done in a fellowship of other people who have been there. Mm-hmm. You said, I'm one of us. I always said I wouldn't necessarily want to have surgery from a surgeon who hasn't had surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to understand something. By the same token, it's nice to have a doctor in recovery treating people with addiction because, you know, this both the awful side of addiction when it's active mm-hmm. and the phenomenal side of recovery that experienced by your provider is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
So what we want to do is we want to get in there with other alcoholics and identify not only with their difficult histories with the substance, but their phenomenal recoveries.
Mm.
And that first thing gives you hope. So, and it is certainly the second step in the 12 steps, you know, came to believe that a power greater than us could restore us to sanity. The first time you get into a meeting with someone who has a story worse than yours and is coming in with, you know, 5 years worth of sobriety, you walk home and say, maybe I'm not so bad. Maybe there's some hope for me. You don't isolate and compare yourself. You finally start to identify. And that's the magic that happens. I see extraordinary miracles, and I've never made a miracle in my life, but I get invited to help in a lot of them. Yeah. Yeah.
It's powerful. It's beautiful. Now, the miracles. Is it possible, in your experience, to get sober and to have long-term recovery without a belief in a higher power or something bigger than ourselves?
Well, that's very important, and I want to answer that question right, because this question has to satisfy the most religious of your listeners and the atheists amongst your listeners. We're all children of something. And some people believe we're children of God. Some people can believe we're children of the planet or children of the universe. And that being said, there has to be connection. There has to be connection. So if you are totally immersed in ego and there is nothing more powerful or important than you, then the first thing you're going to think about with alcohol or any other drug is that I can completely control it because I'm all powerful. Mm. There's nothing else to rely upon. Mm. And those people fall flat on their face over and over from cradle to grave.
Mm.
I've buried a lot of people like that. I've never met anyone too ignorant to get sober, but I've met many people too smart to get sober.
Mm.
Those people who are blessed with the idea, just a notion, and all it takes is the caveat or the slightest crack in the door of willingness that maybe I'm just not the hot, you know what, that I'm supposed to be, okay? Then there's magic that happens because it allows for the healing to begin. And pretty soon everybody starts to convert. Mm-hmm. So that power other, we don't say that. We say power greater than ourselves. Some people just have to start with power other than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they may just say, okay, that room full of 30 alcoholics who are in recovery may know a little bit more about this disease than I do since my last drink was last night.
Mm-hmm.
That's the magic that happens. So in one way or another, there has to be some sort of surrender to the extraordinary power of alcohol and coming around to an idea that I'm not at the top of the pile. There is a power greater than myself. We do it. If we talk about God, it's always with the caveat, as we understood him. The Native Americans may understand that to be the mountain and the great white spirit or the great white clouds. And someone else may say it's the Hindu figure in the corner, and someone else may say it's a statue of Buddha, and someone else may just say it's the breeze and the breath. And no pun, but sorry for the long-winded answer.
No, it's beautiful. And what I heard you say is smashing of the ego is important to achieve that. We have to smash the ego so we're not the be-all. Is that right? And in the 12 steps, it's part of the, it's through the step work that we're able to smash the ego. But what that's...
Well, you know, we have to be very, very careful with language that might prevent someone from accessing help. So I won't talk in terms of ever smashing the ego, but if for some people we gently nudge it aside temporarily, okay?
That's why he's the doctor, folks, and I'm not.
That might be that might be something that people can swallow better, okay? And the program of recovery never asks us to give up who we are, so we don't have to smash an ego. It doesn't prevent our productivity, our chance to be empowered, to create great wealth, or to create great things. It never does that. It does ask us to ascribe some of that benefits to something other than ourselves, and we're only required not to have the power over drugs and alcohol. So that's where we try to remove the ego from it.
Well said. So I want to talk about families. The family is so important with the addiction and the treatment. I know, speaking for me, and I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for my father's willingness to get sober, because if he wouldn't have got sober, I wouldn't have had the motivation to do it. I could have just said, well, nobody else, he's not doing it, so I'm not doing it. And so in my family, my father, he had that willingness. He got sober, and I know he was calling you, very worried about me, trying to get me help. And that, to see my dad leading by example, that was inspiration and motivation for me to get help, because he did it. And how could I say no when he did it at his age? He, of all people, didn't have to do it.
Yeah, I hope your father listens to this, because I do a great imitation of your father, you know. I do.
Let's hear it. Okay. He is listening. He will listen.
Okay. Dr. Harry, this is Bill Schultz. Oh, how are you? Bill Schultz, I'm so worried about my son, Andrew. Bill, are you worried about yourself at all? No, no, worried about my son, Andrew. First time I saw Bill, how did you get those black eyes? What black eyes? Don't know. Must have bumped into the Christmas tree. I just loved it. I just loved it. Well, great man. Great man. Coach, we call him Coach.
And the black eye that Dr. Harry is referring to is my dad shows up at Betty Ford on Christmas morning 2009 with a shiner. And the story he told the people at Betty Ford, the great people, was he slipped on the ice, he ran into the Christmas tree, anything except for the truth of him falling down, and by the grace of God, not just, he's had a lot of lies and that miracle that you speak about. But, you know, for speaking of my dad, I want to make sure we talk about this real quick. He loves this book. This is his big book, and in all the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that my dad attends, he brings this book and he leads about once a month. He leads the meeting and he picks the topic out of this book. And so, thank you. This is his big book. This is my dad's big book. And this is the Bible that he loves. And everybody in his group now loves and knows you because of this book.
How cool.
And one of my favorite stories is, remember, my dad had really, really bad migraines. And when I came up to see him, It was after family week. I came up to see him. He was complaining about his migraines. He didn't know what to do. So he came and saw you. And I think you gave him some B3, vitamin B3. And his migraines went away the next day. And then I remember he came and talked to you. And said, "Hey, Dr. Harry, thank you so much. You know, how the hell did you do that?" And he said, "Dr. Harry, how the hell did you cure my migraine?" And his response, what you said to him was, "Well, shit, Bill, I'm not a used car salesman."
Actually, I said, "What do you think I am, a shoemaker?" Don't be so damn surprised. I pull a rabbit out of the hat once in a while.
And so the cool thing, you know, back to the family, and the reason I'm bringing this up, on the way up here, my drive from San Diego, one of the cool things I get to do is I call my mom, I call my dad. I asked their opinion on what they wanted to hear. As a podcast listener, what would be valuable information, a topic that you and I could talk about? And I actually talked to him yesterday. I gave him last night to think about it, and they called me back on my drive up here. And just for my dad and I to talk about your book and to talk about those stories and laugh, you know, it wouldn't be possible without what you were able to help my family with, to help us get sober, to truly change the trajectory of the Schultz family. And then my mom, who, you know, she, as an outsider, I know what she went through when I was in the depths of my addiction, when I was at rock bottom, and she had the police, she had the hospital on speed dial because she was so scared and so concerned, and what I put my family through. But now to see, I get to talk to her on the way up here. She gave me some questions that I'm going to ask you next about people, the impact of the family, things that we can do. But I just know to get my family back from where I was to where it is now, our relationships, our love is stronger and better now than ever before in sobriety. And I know for me, as long as I take care of myself one breath at a time, one day at a time, my family, everything else around me gets better. But talk about, from your perspective, how important the family dynamic is, and you know, to get the family involved, and tips on families who are listening, what can they do to help loved ones to, you know, codependency is a big issue. Talk to me just about what families can do to be part of the solution versus the problem.
Well, I want to just look across the room and show you those photographs over there. Mm. And there's four men in those photographs, three men and one baby. Mm. Now that baby is now 50 years old. So that those photographs of my grandfather, my father, myself, and my son, three of those four men, with the exception of my grandfather, are alcoholics, all in recovery. Mm. Well, my father passed away. Mm. My father had seven brothers who were alcoholic. Six brothers who were all alcoholic. My two brothers, who are now passed, were alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And we had my son and a couple of nephews that were alcoholics. Now, everybody's in recovery, so we've been able to break the family curse. And the new generation of the young kids that are coming up, my grandchildren and my brothers' grandchildren, have never seen their parents drinking. Mm-hmm. They've never seen their grandparents using. They've never seen that thing. And that's what we can hope for. The main thing that families have to do is find the courage, if not go out to where they sell the courage, to speak up when they see something's wrong. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work with your family doctor, there's Al-Anon meetings that you can go to. But if you find someone you love, the worst thing that can happen is to be looking over them after they've passed and say, "I should have said something. Why didn't I say something?" That's especially true of the young kids that we treat. So I would advise family members to understand that the hardest part of this disease is denial. It's the way that it kills people. I remember speaking with my dear Betty Ford when I was over there, Mrs. Ford, and she said to us in one meeting that I never got treated because there was never anything wrong. There's the denial of the alcoholic and drug addict. There was something terribly wrong, and everybody knew it but Mrs. Ford until they did the intervention. Not all interventions are necessary if someone speaks up early enough or consults a family doctor and says, we need you to speak to so-and-so about the nature of their use or drinking. And if it happens to be drugs and in an older individual, you've got to go to the doctors who more often than not don't speak to each other and call them all to task and say, I want to do an audit of everything this person's taking. That's what my new book's all about. I want to do an audit of everything they're on. Why is there, and it's not uncommon to find that three different doctors are all prescribing the same medicine, except they're either by brand name or not brand name, by a generic name, and people don't recognize they're doubling up on the doses. So, you know, the main thing for families to know is that this disease is not curable, but it's absolutely treatable. And if you are afraid to act, if you are very codependent, if you are afraid to make waves, if you're afraid that, you know, this person that's using is holding you hostage with their reactions or their temper, get help. And there's lots of help out there to break that cycle. Otherwise, you're part of the problem. And you can be an enabler. You know, it's pretty easy to be an enabler. I like him better when he's drunk because he's not so grumpy or he falls asleep early. That's not unusual. I'm afraid to say something because they're going to lose their temper or withhold, you know, my allowance or something. So, you know, the main thing is don't be caught by the denial. And if you don't have the wisdom and knowledge, there's lots of great books to look at. Being Sober is one. Thank you very much. I love the book Love First, which is a wonderful book that teaches the family how to think about this disease in intervention terms. And that's by Jeff and Deborah Jay. Those are some of the books that we give to people early on, and Not As Prescribed, the guide to older adults is good. And by the way, I never plug my books because I've never made a nickel on them. Every time someone buys one of my books, we try to give away two or three. So, you know, they get sent to the prisons and churches and places where people can't afford the books or don't have access. So I feel comfortable about telling you the names of them on your podcast because, you know, if someone buys it, they're buying two, actually. One will be given away.
Awesome. So me, as a future parent, I don't have kids yet. However, that's the plan. So there's a genetic disposition with it's in my family, my father, me. Is there anything I could do or other parents out there who have not had kids yet who are afflicted with the addiction, is there anything that they can do with their genetic disposition?
Nothing you can do about the genetic disposition other than to be on the lookout and to educate. You want to try to avoid any kid that's exposed at too young an age while the brain is still developing. You want to teach them a hearty respect for the family disease if it's running through generations. It's unnatural for kids to not want the forbidden fruit. And I like them to know more about the joy of mindfulness and a drug-free life, that is the joy of recovery, as a positive attraction rather than trying to keep them away from the taboo substance that everybody else is using. Not and difficult, but not impossible. I like to see the young people involved in some spiritual exercise, whether that's, you know, mindfulness walks and thanking the Great Spirit for the trees and the woods, or going to church with their Bible. It really doesn't make much difference which, so long as they start to connect with that magic. The truth of the matter is that alcohol and other drugs get you to the point where your brain, and by the way, my third book is Hijacking the Brain, which is a little bit technical for most people, but it talks about the biochemistry of recovery. And what happens in recovery is very similar to what happens in meditation and what happens during a yoga exercise. What happens to a child when they're nursing at their mother's breast? And what happens to the mother when the child's nursing at their breast? Oxytocin, the recovery hormone, the mother of all hormones, is secreted and gives you that wonderful, calm, joyful feeling that we seek. A lot of people are looking for that and mistakenly seek out drugs and alcohol for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But that's not where it is. Alcohol and drugs, if you are susceptible, wants to scan your body for the gene, see if you're susceptible, and then addict you to the feeling of getting loopy or high or drunk or whatever. But the real fact is that the feeling of getting high, loopy, or drunk is the feeling you get when brain cells are being injured or killed.
Brain damage.
Exactly. So addiction obsesses you with the idea of using, despite the fact that it's causing damage to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it can be irreversible damage, but it's causing damage to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the feeling we get when we're drunk, you know, seeing double, talking with slurred speech and being unable to balance yourself or stumble, you know, driving with one eye closed, all that nonsense is of intoxication is damaging, is when the brain is being damaged.
Mm.
It's not unlike getting hit helmet to helmet on the football field, you know, not unlike concussions. It behaves very similarly. So educating kids that are susceptible, a healthy respect, letting them know that a presence of mind is what's really going to matter in this world, and that when intoxicated, what they say may not make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
The connections that they have to other people under the influence are not true connections. And they may inadvertently hurt themselves and other people when they really don't want to.
I love how you talked about the oxytocin. I know for me in my recovery, that feeling of when I'm in yoga or when I'm in meditation or walking on the beach in nature, that feeling, that's not in the 12 steps. It's something that I do, a mindfulness practice that I try to do every day, that I'm so glad you talked about that and the importance of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because in me and for my recovery, it's been it's been so important.
Mm-hmm.
So I like how you said that, and to educate the kids on a joy of recovery, in your words. I love that.
And you know, we also have to, let's not forget the worst of all addictions is still nicotine.
Mm.
And look what's happened with the vaping crisis in this country, because someone didn't stop and for the sake of greed and money made a very deadly addictive substance taste good for young kids. It's criminal, and I hope it's treated that way. I mean, it's just criminal. What we have to do with the kids is educate them about the what we have to do with the parents is to educate them about the dangers of drug solutions for simple ailments. You know, you don't need dextromethorphan, which is like an opiate, for a cough. Lemon and honey works great.
Mm.
You know, you don't need Sudafed, which is a stimulant and precursor for methamphetamine, because your nose is a little stuffy. Steam works wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You don't need Adderall, Ritalin, and other highly addictive amphetamines in the body of someone with the genetics for addiction, because they're not paying attention in school the way you'd like. The diagnosis of ADHD is running rampant. We have an epidemic of ADHD diagnosis, and far too few people that really, really have found out they don't really qualify for that disease. And you're exposing them to some of the most powerful chemicals that are almost certain to lead them. I have a young man in our clinic right now, 16 years of age. Well, his parents thought that he had a problem, and besides that, all the kids in college were on it. And besides that, they study harder. And besides that, they'll get higher SATs. And parents are actually sending the kids to get these medicines to increase their learning potential. Well, this kid told me that that's where it all started, and we're treating him now for his heroin addiction at 17.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, as you know, that was my drug that really led to meth, because I had abused all the relationships with doctors in San Diego. And I had lied to them, not telling them about the predisposition to alcohol so I could get it. And then I started doctor shopping, and that led to meth because that was easier to get. But I'm glad you brought up the Adderall. And the damage to the brain is a whole nother story, especially as I was taking 280 to 300 milligrams a day. Which leads me into, you mentioned opiates a little bit ago. I want to talk briefly about the opiate epidemic. The same concept of doctors overprescribing ADHD medicine, Ritalin and Adderall, to kids. Same thing is happening at the opiate level. And doctors are handing out, it seems, a disproportionately amount of medicine. Now it's getting so bad that states are suing drug manufacturers and distributors. Talk to me about your perspective of what you're seeing in the opiate crisis, your perspective, and a follow-up to that. If you were consulting one of the states who's going to get a large amount of money from this settlement, how would you put that money to use to be part of the solution?
That's a hell of a question. There's no question about it. I put the bulk of the blame on physicians who are undereducated about the nature of these drugs, prescribing vast amounts for relatively minor or short-lived pain. But I think everyone needs to own a portion of this. When I went to medical school, we never prescribed opiates. They were considered far too addictive and dangerous. Well, I'm a little long in tooth, you know, that's back in the 70s and 80s. And then we wouldn't use phenobarbital because that's what killed Marilyn Monroe, and it was far too powerful. We just had a healthy, healthy idea. And then all of a sudden, around the mid-90s, I believe, if you want to change a physician's behavior, threaten them with a lawsuit. That's the only thing that motivates physicians and a lot of professionals. It's the fear of recrimination, monetary or legally. So what happened was that people started suing doctors for being undertreated for their pain, because doctors were so conservative about using these medications. This is when the specialty of pain management started up, and people with cancer pain, who certainly deserve to have as many opiates as they might require, there was a lot of noise about this. And what happened was that it became mandatory to ask patients what their pain level was. So this is when people started saying, are you a 1 to 10 on your pain scale, or are you a happy face or a sad face in the emergency room regarding your pain? And at the same time, whether it was planned, wink, wink, or not planned, Purdue Pharma and the rest of them came out with mega potent pain medications that they totally marketed with the bogus notion that it's not addictive. One of the most common phrases in the English language is, it's not addictive, by the way, and far too overused. Well, that's how it was marketed. And doctors said, thank God we have something now that we can give patients. And so patients quickly learn that all they had to do is say, I'm an 8, 9, or 10 on the pain scale, and I'm going to get the happy medicine. And they used it tremendously. Doctors who were conservative now became very liberal. And you went to the dentist for a filling and you came home with 30 Vicodin. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So, yes, the medical profession has to own a huge amount of this blame. Yes, the unscrupulous marketing of the big drug companies that made all this money. It's all, you want to blame it on one thing, blame it on greed. A terribly ugly human character flaw. Greed is what it's all about. And people were making far too much money. The doctors who handed out these massive amounts of prescriptions when they saw a patient for 5 minutes, gave them a prescription, got a huge amount of cash. Every one of them should be behind bars. As far as I'm concerned, every single one of them is a dangerous criminal and should be behind bars, stripped of their medical license, never to practice again. The monies that are now being settled upon, which are, by the way, minuscule to the monies that have been made. In the Sackler family, for example, you take a look at the distribution, $2-4 million per member, and the amounts that they're thinking about paying into the general fund are minuscule. I saw one settlement by Johnson & Johnson, which was made no sense. What to do with all that money? Well, I certainly would have some restitution to the families of the 11 people that die every hour in this country.
From opiate overdose.
From opiate overdose, or now, you know, the problem's gotten much bigger than just prescription drugs, of course, because of fentanyl. Education of physicians. With enforcement, I'd certainly like to see someone provide housing and dignity for the homeless, which no one seems to find the money for, many of whom have drug and alcohol issues. It's just some of the things in my items,
Switching gears. As we wrap up, there's one thing that I really wanted to get your thoughts on. And there's been some very promising results from, I know, Johns Hopkins, NYU, about using psychedelics for treatment of depression, anxiety, addiction, nicotine. I know the Johns Hopkins, they just did a thing on 60 Minutes. 80% of the smokers quit after taking psilocybin, which is the component, it's the non-addictive agent in magic mushrooms. Psilocybin, it's the psychedelic in magic mushrooms. 80% of smokers quit after taking psilocybin, and double the success rate that other smoking cessation products have. Also, early results look good and promising for addiction. What are your thoughts on the psychedelics as a potential, maybe years down the road, but a potential treatment of addiction?
I've seen far too many, quote, non-addictive, non-dangerous, unquote, remedies come out that have backfired. So I'm pretty cautious about those things. I mean, you're talking psychedelics, you're talking about manipulating very delicate brains with enormously powerful chemicals. Fine, you may stop smoking. That may be great, but what else happens? So I can't really comment on. I'm not closed-minded to anything that helps, especially with the more addictive substances that are eventually going to damage everyone, like nicotine. But I do know that there are easier and softer ways to deal with the problem of addiction rather than just manipulating brain chemistry with these sledgehammers.
All right.
But by the same token, I should say that we've seen recently very powerful effects on depression from drugs like ketamine, which also cause a dysphoria or an altered mind consciousness. So, you know, I'm not close to that. I think that's a very, very positive potential. But with psilocybin and that kind of stuff, I'm not quite sure.
Fair enough. All right. Couple other questions. Rapid fire as we wrap up.
I want to add one thing.
Yeah, please.
All that money they're collecting
from
should be used to develop the vaccines that are probably the wave of the future to prevent addiction. And those kids you were talking about that were highly exposed, in the future we should have vaccines.
There we go. I like that.
Okay.
I like that. I appreciate your time. Thank you again. This has been phenomenal. We're definitely going to have round two. I know people are going to clamor and demand more of your expertise to share. So we'll do round two again soon. Looking back over your life and the impact you've had, what are you, and you've changed the lives of so many thousands and thousands of people, saving lives, being of service, changing the trajectory of the families, giving hope. As you look back, what's the one thing you're most proud of?
Most
proud of that you've done?
My son's recovery.
Oh, how long has he been?
15 years.
15 years sober?
Yeah. And I always like to tell him I can be proud of his recovery, and he can be proud of my recovery, but we can't be proud of our own recovery. Then we're missing the boat. But my son's recovery I'm the most proud of.
So as you're hearing me talk about, and you've experienced my father and I, because you've had a huge part of our, you know, recovery, I love it that and you guys can share in your own, you and your sons.
Yeah.
If you relate.
Pretty awesome. You know, breaking the family legacy.
Yeah.
And I should say that also goes for my nephews who've worked very hard to get their new coins, which is really great.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What do you want your legacy to be as you look back? You ever think about your legacy and what you want that to be?
You know, I have a picture in my office that really shows what the roots of my history in medicine is. It's an old country doctor with a little girl holding a doll up, and he's listening to the doll with a stethoscope. I think that old country medicine approach to the addict and alcoholic who still suffers is one that makes people a lot less afraid of what physicians can and should be able to do for them. I'd like to see my legacy that I brought old-fashioned country medicine to addiction.
I love that picture.
Yeah. It's great.
Best advice you ever received?
Don't drink and go to meetings.
Who had the biggest influence on your life?
My father-in-law. My father-in-law, who lives in San Diego, is an Auschwitz survivor and 91 years of age. And a giant of a man who has had tremendous, tremendous influence on my life. And my mother, Grandma Toni, who had three boys with the same disease as her husband, but never, ever lost faith.
Mm.
Pretty amazing.
And for everybody listening, as we wrap up, how can people, what's the best way for people to get a hold of you? Is it through, we have info@drharrymd.net, your website, drharrybeingsober.com, and the phone number 760-674-0005. What's the best way for people who want more information, who want maybe some help? What's the best way for people to reach you and get in touch with you?
Call that 0005 number. Okay. Speak with Jackie. She's puts our blogs on.
Okay.
And can help people and direct people to the appropriate staff members or myself that can help.
Perfect. Again, that phone number 760-674-0005. I will put that in the show notes so you guys have that in case you're driving. Anything else, Dr. Harry, as we wrap up with our time together?
Drive safely.
Drive safely. Well, thank you again for your time. I want to just acknowledge you one more time for the impact that you've had on me, my father, my family, and so many other families. Your service, your commitment, your dedication, thousands and thousands of people have benefited and are in a better place because of you. And I just want to say thank you again. You're a dear friend, and it just means the world to share this space with you, to be up here 4.5 years later, sober and thriving, and it wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for you. So I just want to say thank you again.
Just remind those who have families that if they think something's wrong, probably something is wrong. Don't be afraid to speak up.
Mm. Speak up. All right, guys, thank you for listening. I will put Dr. Harry's contact information in the show notes. And thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, guys.